welcome to Garden Talk. I'm Jill Nadeau. Thanks for joining us on the Ideas Network. Vijay Pandian is back with us today. He is a horticulture agent and educator for the UW Extension in Kenosha, Milwaukee, and Racine counties. We'll talk to him about an invasive tree. And of course, we'd like to hear from you. What gardening questions do you have for him? How are your tomatoes doing? What about your apples? Join in by giving us a call, 800-642-1234, or you can send an email to ideas@wpr.org. Hi, Vijay. Thanks for joining us.
Morning, Jill. Thanks for the opportunity.
You bet. We always love to have you with us. So what's this about the Tree of Heaven? It sounds like a beautiful tree.
Well, in fact, actually, it is not a beautiful tree. It's like a tree of hell, I would say. The name seems to be misnomer, at least in the United States or in North America, I would say. And, I mean, it is not a new invasive species. It is, you know, it's been in the United States since in 1700s.
Oh.
And, it was introduced in the East Coast area, in Philadelphia area first. And initially, this tree was has the popularity because it's one of the fast-growing trees. It can get about easily 80 feet tall, you know, and it is widely adaptable. You know, you can plant it in a parking lot or in a compacted soil, wet soil, you know. So it has a wide range of adaptation. So it gained its popularity back in the time. And then it was introduced in 1850s in West Coast. Only in 1900s, people started to see the weediness of this invasive species, that it has this prolific root system that it can poke and crack the foundations, and the tree can produce, a single female tree can produce 300,000 seeds in a year.
Oh, my.
I know. That is not the worst part, I would say. Besides that, it actually tends to sucker out from its root. So from a single mother plant, you can able to see a clump about extending about 50 feet from the mother plant. So it can form a dense thicket vegetation. And so the reason why Tree of Heaven started to gain the significance right now, and especially in upper Midwest, is because it's another preferred host. It's a preferred host for spotted lanternfly, which is another invasive species insect that is knocking on its door in the Midwest area. And its primary preferred host is a Tree of Heaven. So, and that makes it more significant for us, actually, to identify the Tree of Heaven and to control it.
Mm-hmm.
So far, this Tree of Heaven doesn't support any of our native species, insects, or wildlife animals. So, and it outcompetes any other plant species. And it also has tendency not to allow any other species to grow nearby because the root system produces a chemical called allelopathic type of chemical, which inhibits any other species to grow. So it's more like a bullying other different plant species, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So it has all kind of negative characteristics that makes it more unique invasive species. So that is another significance right now that, okay, now the spotted lanternfly is on its way. And we know that it is a preferred host for Tree of Heaven. It is a preferred host. So we need to tackle this Tree of Heaven right at this juncture, you know, before this invasive insect comes back to us.
Mm-hmm. Well, that makes a lot of sense. I had never been aware of this tree before, and I was surprised when you said that it was been here for so long. Why don't you describe it for people so that they know what they're looking at?
Absolutely. I mean, so far in Wisconsin, we don't have a pretty good idea about its entire distribution in the state. Most of the identification comes from the southern part of Wisconsin. So in urban areas, in Milwaukee, Kenosha, Racine, Dane County, Jefferson County, there's one spotting in La Crosse, and then one way up in Washoe County. So, but we do know that, okay, it is spread around, but not many people don't know how to identify and how to report it. So that is the biggest drawback that we right now we have. So the Tree of Heaven, you know, has a large compound leaves, pinnately compound leaves. The leaf looks similar to black walnut or a sumac tree leaves. So that makes it very difficult to identify it. But the key characteristic about the leaves of this Tree of Heaven is that their leaflet that looks like a black walnut, it has about like a large size, about 1 to 4 feet long, and it has about like 11 to 40 leaflets. So, and the leaves are very glossy. And the key thing about it, identifying the based on the leaves, is that the edges of the leaves are smooth. At the, but the base of the leaf, you see a small protruding bump. We call it a glandular teeth. So it has a couple of, you know, protruding bump at the base of it. That is very distinct for Tree of Heaven. Black walnut or tree or staghorn sumac doesn't have this kind of bump at its base, and they all have serrated teeth to it, but mm-hmm. Tree of Heaven has a smooth edge. So that's one key characteristic to identify. The second thing I look for in Tree of Heaven to identify is to look at the bark of the tree. The bark of the tree is smooth and grayish in color, and the skin looks like a skin of a cantaloupe. So it's very distinct, okay? So it's kind of like a unique bark to it. But right now, if you drive around, the one key characteristic you can easily spot out the Tree of Heaven is looking at its seed pod. The seed pod, we call it samaras. Just like this box of the tree has this kind of like a seed pod, we call samaras. Mm-hmm. Just like that, Tree of Heaven has it. But the thing is that the color of the samaras right now are about like pinkish to reddish in color. So it's very bright. And so it'll easily catch your attention right away and might be wondering, oh, why this tree is flowering right now with this bright pod, bright color. And but if you look closely, those are seed pods. And these seed pods can cling on to the tree even throughout the winter time. So these are some few pertinent characteristics that helps you to distinguish Tree of Heaven compared to black walnut tree or staghorn sumac.
Mm-hmm. And I did put a link to the DNR's page where it does have some descriptions on our program note. So if someone wants to go to WPR.org/Larry, look at today's show and you'll see that link. Otherwise, just go to the DNR Wisconsin and Tree of Heaven and you'll find all kinds of information. Because, I mean, when I saw the pictures, it looks like a sumac to me. But when you see relatively that they are quite large.
So. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. You know, besides the Wisconsin DNR resource page, our extension weed science specialist, Dr. Mark Renz, has created a wonderful, a program called the Wisconsin Fuss Detector Network Program. So where the citizens can able to report it about any of these invasive species into the national database list. So just Google up Wisconsin Fuss Detector Network, and where you can be able to report any of these invasive species. Just like DNR, you know, you can also have a wonderful resources on various fact sheets and YouTube videos on how to identify these invasive species. So, you know, either you can use Wisconsin DNR, or you can also use, you know, Dr. Mark Ren's Wisconsin Fuss Detector Network to report any of these invasive species as well.
Okay, great. That's a really good asset to know about. And we'll also put that on our program note, too, so you can find it there also. So, excellent. Okay, so what if someone says, oh, gosh, I think I have a Tree of Heaven. And you know what? You're right. It is taking over my yard. What should they do?
Well, that's a very good question. The very first thing is to report this invasive species. So that will really help us out to strategize, okay, in down the road when we happen to have a spotted landed fly, how to, eradicate this Tree of Heaven or how to better manage this Tree of Heaven. So if a homeowner has it in the backyard or probably in the nearby the driveway area, or if any municipal people can be able to spot it actually in the boulevard area, they can report this invasive species first. Either you can go to the Wisconsin Fuzz Detector Network site and report this invasive species, or you can go through Wisconsin DNR as well.
Mm-hmm.
So once you reported it, you know, in terms of controlling it, here's a few things you need to know. First thing, people always think, why don't I cut it or mow it? That is a bad idea.
Oh, that would have been my first guess.
Yeah, because people, you know, we all know, you know, we don't want to use it. We have this kind of thing. You know, the chemical application is a last resort.
Right.
We always think that. So we tend to do, first thing is, why don't I cut it or mow it? The tree of heaven has a very strong resprouting capacity.
Mm.
So once you cut it, it'll resprout like a hell. And you might regret it. Oh, my God, what did I do, actually? Instead of trying to solve the problem, you are multiplying the problem because it tends to sucker out quite a bit.
Mm.
So you need to carefully, you know, strategize how to control it. You cannot control it in a single year. So you do need to follow up in like 2 to 3 years. So the first thing to do is see what type of, you know, habitat it has and what's the size of it, how much it's spread in that area. That all determines how you're going to manage it. So for instance, okay, if you do have a large size tree, okay, that is about like, you know, more than about like a 6 inches in diameter or something like that, don't do any cut stump method right away. I mean, many of the invasive species, we do a cut stump method, which means that you cut to the base of the tree, paint it with a concentrated, you know, glyphosate. That is a wrong idea in tree of heaven. So the first thing, if you do have a large size tree, what you have to do, so you need to do a hand and squirt method treating. What it means is that take a hand axe and about 18 inches from the ground, just make a downward axe cut. And then leave about 3 to 4 inches from the first cut, go to the another spot of the bark and make another cut. So give about even spacing about 3 to 4 inches and make a, you know, an axe cut. Immediately in those cut areas, fill it with some concentrated Roundup or concentrated triclopyr herbicide into it. And after the tree dies in about 30 days or so, then you can cut down the tree, you know, to its base, and you can dispose it. Before you dispose it, make sure you remove the seed part, put it in a black plastic bag, and you trash it in the landfill. So that is for a large mature trees we are talking about it. Unless this large mature tree poses a serious hazardous risk, then you can follow the traditional cut stump method. If not, do the hand and squirt method first and then wait for 30 days and then follow up with the cut method. The second thing is that if you do have less than 6 inches diameter type of thing, then probably you can use a basal bark treatment. Basically, from the ground all the way to 18 inches, you can use, you know, oil-based, you know, triclopyr-formulated herbicide, and you can actually spray it evenly around the bark of the tree. So this is called basal bark treatment, and you can follow that as well.
Okay. Yeah, that's kind of usually, like you said, the last thing we think about. But this, in this case, we really have to bring out the big guns, huh?
Yeah. And the timing is very crucial, too. I mean, if you tend to spray it in the, you know, springtime or like late springtime, early summer, midsummer, sometimes these treatments may not work. You know, it may cause some damages, but it may not. So ideally, late summer, early to mid-fall, early fall, I would say, you know, would be ideal.
Mm-hmm.
That's the time many of these herbicides gets translocated to the root system, and the tree sends out most of its carbohydrates back to the root system, too. So they, you know, naturally, you know, controlling the root system will knock out the entire plant. They schedule this type of management strategies late summer, early fall.
Okay, so that time is coming up. So it's,
yes,
look for those trees. We're talking with Vijay Pandya, and he's the horticulture agent and educator for the UW Extension in Kenosha, Milwaukee, and Racine counties. Join in with your questions or comments by calling 800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. Our on-air producer today is Clara Neipert, and Tyler Ditter is our technical director. This is Garden Talk on the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau. Join us every Friday or listen again on Saturday mornings at 6. You can also go online and listen to our archives at any time. Coming up next week, Susan Carpenter will be back to talk about native gardens. And right now, we can pretty much take up any topic you have in your garden because Vijay is just that good. Right now, we're talking a little bit about invasives in that tree of heaven. But you can also send an email, and we do have a couple of them. So let's talk about that. I need to find it. Here we go. Sandy in Oshkosh emailed us. They established a new asparagus and strawberry patch in a raised bed about 3 years ago. Now, the asparagus is doing great. The strawberries, not so much. For the past 2 years, the yield has been tiny and the berries small. The plants also only bears in the spring, and they've never seen as much as a flower after the first bearing. Should they replace the berries with a different kind, or might the issue be having the strawberries next to the asparagus?
Well, it all depends. You know, what type of strawberry she's been growing. There are three different types of strawberries. One is the summer bearing strawberries, which actually start producing the fruit in June. Mm-hmm. And then usually the summer bearing strawberries, you know, will start producing in second, third year onwards. You know, you'll start to see more bumper crops in third year onwards. And, you know, you can cultivate it till for 5 years. And then we also have the ever-bearing strawberries as well. And the ever-bearing strawberries will start producing slowly from the summertime, extends all the way till about early fall, early to mid-fall. That is the ever-bearing strawberries. They last only for 2 years. After that, you know, they lose its vitality and, you know, you'll start to see a decline in its production. The third kind is a day-neutral one, which lives only for 1 year, and it produces in a single, like an annual one. Mm. It produces a bumper crop. Usually, people use a day-neutral for like containers or, you know, grow bags and those kind of things. You know, so depending on what type of strawberry plants you're growing, what kind you're growing, your cultural practices could vary too. So if you're looking for the typical summer-bearing type of strawberry plant, you know, make sure you give a good spacing for them because they're going to be there for 5 years, okay? And if you do plant them in a closer planting, they produce so much of these runners and outcompete with them, and then you're going to see a decrease in yield, you know, based on that. So at the same time, fertilization is also very important too. If you don't provide enough good fertilization, that also going to impact, you know, your fruit production. The other key thing also you need to know about is that, you know, strawberries, you know, do perform very well, you know, in sunlight. So if you don't have enough sunlight, you know, at least about 6 to 8 hours, you know, you're not going to get enough number of flowers, and that's also going to impact your fruit production too. And again, frost. That's also a major factor. So we don't know when the spring frost is going to happen. And if it happens exactly at the time when the strawberries are in bloom, it also going to reduce its inner yield as well, too. So there are multiple factors involved into it why your strawberry plant is not performing very well. So start checking by what type of strawberries you have, whether it gets full sun, whether you applied enough fertilizer at the right timing, whether you have given enough spacing to those strawberry plants. So all these things influence its yield.
And anything as far as the asparagus goes, does that make any difference?
Not so much as long as you give us actually enough spacing between one of the asparagus patches with the strawberry one. Generally speaking, I don't mix two different perennials together very well. You know, if she's growing actually, you know, an annual strawberry plant, that makes sense. But if you're mixing like a perennial strawberries, that is like a day neutral, sorry, the ever bearing and the summer bearing one, mm-hmm. along with the asparagus patch, you know, these two perennials, they live for long. They outcompete with each other because for nutrients, water, and everything. Okay, so again, you know, wish we had some more info on how big of a raised bed she has. Generally, if you go with a standard type of raised bed with a 4 feet wide, then it is not a good idea to mix two different perennials together.
Okay, great. Okay, thanks for that email, and thanks for all that info, Vijay. Let's go to the phones now. Roger in Grantsburg has a comment or question. Roger, go ahead.
Hi, how are you doing? Good morning. Yes, about the invasive species. Invasive. Geez, I always got a problem with that. We got an issue up here. I live up in Grantsburg, which up in Burnett County, northwestern part of the state. We got a big issue with buckthorn up here. It's just getting into places and it's taking over, and it's like, it's almost impossible is what it sounds like, the tree you have, and then you're saying how it's hard to get rid of. This buckthorn is just the same way. It's just massively hard. The only way to do it is to go and pull the roots right out. You gotta basically de-root everything, or it just keeps on going, and all.
Yeah, we've got it down here too, Roger. Vijay, how do you suggest people deal with it?
Well, the first thing is that you need to understand the fact that buckthorn has naturalized in our ecosystem.
Yeah.
It is not easy to get rid of it. It's everywhere. It is prolific, okay? And the birds are one of the key things to spread it. Besides, you know, it tends to, you know, suck it out too.
Mm-hmm.
So if you do find buckthorn in a heavy woodlot area, woodland area, you need to strategize it. So you need to strategize it from, in a five-year plan. So the first few years, you need to tackle and identify what the mother plant is, where the mother plant is. The mother plant is the one which is a large shrub or like a small-sized tree, okay?
Mm-hmm.
It's more than about 6 to 8 inches diameter, trunk. Identify that one as the first couple of years. And cut it down in the fall time, So you use a cut and stump method and cut it up. Because once you eliminate the mother plant that produces that much berries, you actually knocking down in a multiple generations, okay, that's going to sprout down the years, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And that will be the first strategy to use. The second strategy, to find out, okay, start from the outside edges of your woodland areas, okay, and then go towards inside. So in the outside, in the outlier areas, you typically find the thickets of these buckthorns, like some maybe about like an inch, 2 inches, or sometimes even more of a seedling thing. So those things, you can treat them in the fall time, either use a basal bark application, or you can do a foliar application. So always be careful about the spray drift, okay? So if you have any of the native species nearby, you need to be careful about it. But start from the outlying areas and then slowly progress towards the inside. So repeat that in about 2 to 3 years and make a, go in that kind of strategy. So you need to strategize yourself, Now, people also, in a small areas, in a small isolated infested areas, yes, you can also pull some of those, buckthorns. If the seedlings are tiny seedlings and the soil is moist, you can able to pull them out. But, if it gets a little bit more like a shrubby forms, okay, with a lot of, thickets, then it's hard to pull those things out, but there are some specialized tools available, mechanical tools available that you can rent it to, dig it out from the, completely, the roots and suckers. But it's going to take some time, but it is practicable too.
Now, a few years ago, we talked to someone who had come up with this idea of a sort of like a little plastic, cover that you put on the end of the stump that you've cut. Has that been working out? Have you heard of that?
Yes. In fact, I think I also had a conversation with Dr. Mokrins, our weed science specialist, about it. And yes, it does work, actually, to eliminate some of the resprouting happening up. So you can cover it up with some, a thick, containers or plastics or something like that. You can cover up the stump. It helps in reducing some of the resprouting that's happening, that can happen after doing the cut stump method, yes.
Okay. Well, thank you for that call, Roger. Be patient and keep working at it. Thanks for talking about that. Next up, we have Colette in Eagle River. Hi, Colette. What's on your mind?
Okay. Hi, I have some questions about strawberries again in far northern Wisconsin. And last year, we had this great crop of strawberries. I picked and picked and froze. And this year, it's like we had beautiful flowers, and then it was like they got halfway green, and it's like something went through and cut them all off with the scissors. Literally, we would find them in the between the rows and on the ground, and we're like, what the heck? We talked to a botanist out of the place we bought the strawberry plants, and they listed this one sort of beetle or another that would, or some other things that would do. Of course, they listed the way to fix it was this very lethal poison that you're going to spray early in the season. I'm going, I don't want to spray my. I'm going trying to go pretty much organic. I don't want to spray my strawberries, which you eat directly, and I'm very close to lakes and things. I don't want to contaminate the lakes. Do you have any idea what it might be and what I can do organically to stop it from happening?
Okay.
Well, the first thing I would say is that, okay, next year, if you do notice a similar type of damage, right away, reach out to one of our extension educators. Send us a photograph or a sample, so we can able to help out in diagnosing what's happening now. So, I haven't heard any specific deadly insects or diseases that can affect homeowners in the strawberry plants, in a large scale at this point. But I can tell you from my trial garden, we planted some strawberry plants, this spring. And like what you said, we found out that one day morning, all of my strawberry plant, including some of the runners and the fruits are all chopped out, cut out completely. We were disappointed. And we are trying to wonder what the culprit is. And we found out it might be a gray squirrel because we do have a lot of squirrels around to it. And that really invaded our strawberry patches, and it really cut off most of those things to bare root. We didn't have much leaves at all, and everything got stripped out, including the fruits and everything. So what we did to do is that we installed some like a fencing one around my strawberry patches. And after that, we didn't have any of this kind of incursion, from those squirrels or chipmunks that encountering, eating our strawberry patches. So the key thing right now I'm going to advise you is to be patient. Next year, when you do find, as early as possible, a similar type of damage, give a call to one of your local extension educator or send us a picture, okay, to our horticulture extension program. So you can Google up, Wisconsin Horticulture Extension, and where you can send us a picture and you can report it and we can able to diagnose it right away.
Okay, thank you very much, Colette. Yeah, I was thinking some kind of critter, too, because that definitely sounds like something that they would do. The damage they can do, it's crazy. If you've got a question for Vijay, give us a call, 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And, of course, you can send an email to ideas@wpr.org. And let's take one of those emails. Vicki emailed us. She lives in Mequon, and she would like recommendations on screening trees. They have two 40 to 50 foot long berms that separate their property from their neighbors. And please suggest an arborvitae that is deer resistant, does not grow taller than 12 to 15 feet. hardy for our winters, are tolerant of some shade from neighboring trees, or would you suggest a different kind? They currently have Austrian pine and spruce that are dying.
Well, you know, in terms of, you know, arborvitaes, I mean, they are excellent for screening purpose, and they are evergreen, and probably, you know, it can take pot shade, but it prefers mostly, you know, full sun. And arborvitaes are relatively a fast-growing one. But the problem with the common type of arborvitae is that they're also prone to deer. The deer can browse it very easily. So one type of arborvitae, which can be more of a deer-resistant or deer-tolerant, I would say, is a green giant arborvitae. Now, the green giant arborvitae is actually, you know, Thuja placata. And so it's called the Western arborvitae. The traditional arborvitae is a, you know, Eastern arborvitae. Now, this green giant one is a very fast-growing. It's a pyramidal habit to it. And so deer don't like it, but, you can plant this one. They can get about easily about, like, you know, 30 to 40 feet tall, you know. So, and so that would be, you know, one choice to consider. Now, one thing I would recommend, you know, in screening thing is that we all love, actually, you know, we all like to have some sort of like a privacy. But the problem with having a monoculture of a single species screening wall is that if one plant dies, it creates an unaesthetic appearance, you know,
yeah.
And then you have to find another one, and you don't get actually, you know, 30 or 40 feet tall screening plant right away to fill in. And sometimes some of these plants take a while. So when you're designing a screening plant, always go with a mixed bed. So combination of both evergreen and deciduous plant in a mixed bed type of system, rather than having a monoculture of the same species, you know. In that way, having a mixed culture, a planting bed, you can able to support a lot of wildlife. You can also able to have, you know, enjoy the beauty of it. Having a different type of scenic views from spring to all the way to the winter. And the other thing is that even if one dies, the other neighboring plant species can able to fill in and cover it up. So there are a lot of pros in having a mixed type of planting bed rather than having a monoculture of a single, you know, a row of arborvitae or a single row of juniper, upright juniper, or any other evergreen species.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a great point. Now, she did say she wanted something that doesn't grow taller than 12 to 15 feet. Is it possible to prune back one of those arborvitaes to stay in that?
You can definitely shear some of those arborvitaes, but sometimes this is the natural form, then probably you need to, appreciate it and understand it. If not, it's going to create too much work, on your end, mm-hmm. So that is a big problem, mm-hmm. But sometimes, trying to find an ideal plant species that can fit to, your requirement is always a bit challenging.
Yes, for sure. We've got a lot of people who have these specific the parameters that they need to fill, and sometimes there just isn't anything. So let's go back to the phone. We've got lots of calls here. John in Highland, what can we help you with?
Hi. I've got a question about pokeweed. The first time I saw, by the way, this is, relates to Oak Park, Illinois, which is where I live. The first time I saw it, I said, oh, my God, what a beguiling plant. Really beautiful.
It
but
is.
They grow all over the place, including a whole bunch that I have underneath a long-neglected yew. And by the time I'm finished digging them all up, I have to be in bed for about 2 days from stooping to dig them all out to the root. Do you have any advice about it other than moving to an apartment?
So pokeweed, is actually, you know, you can able to control it. You know, if you don't want to dig it, you know, probably, you know, the best thing to do is to apply some herbicides, you know, probably in the late summer, early fall, that will take it down to the root system. That will be the best way to go about it if you don't want to dig it up. But, you know, you're right, you know, it does have a pretty decent sized taproot system, and it can be difficult to dig it out or remove it. And so perhaps the other approach would be is to constantly, you know, hack at it or cut it out, you know, and it'll re-sprout back again. And you can keep on doing it until it, you know, depletes its energy from the taproot system. So, so these are some two strategies that you can think about. The other thing is that in a the birds may be one of the reasons for its primary spread, because the birds love its fruits, you know. So probably, you know, if you do see some of those things that sprouts back again, it's more likely from the bird. And again, you know, this is a toxic plant, and so don't think it's like a, you know, June berries or something like that and eat it. So, yeah.
No, please do not eat it. But he's right. It is a beautiful plant, and I can understand why people would want to grow it. But yeah, very, very toxic. So good luck with that. Next up, we've got Catherine in Delavan. Hi, Catherine.
Hi. So I have a little devil nine bark bush, and it has a lot of bare branches at the top, and they weren't there last year. What could I do to get rid of the bare branches without hurting the plant? And also, I'm wondering what the cause might be of all the bare branches at the top of the bush.
Okay. So nine bark, I mean, many cultivars of nine barks, they are highly prone to a fungal disease called powdery mildew. You might think that powdery mildew is more of a cosmetic disease, but on certain plant species, this powdery mildew could be devastating to them. So powdery mildew is a fungal disease associated with high humidity. If you do see powdery mildew, the one of the classical symptoms or sign of those powdery mildew is that as if someone spread some talcum powder, white powder, on the surface of the leaves. And nine bark is very prone to this fungal disease, and that causes some extensive defoliation on it. And so every year, if you do happen to see this powdery mildew causing defoliation, it will tend to weaken the stem and causes them to die back. Because if you don't have enough carbohydrate that has been produced by the leaf, because the leaves are all infected with the fungal disease, they won't have enough energy to withstand the winter temperatures. So naturally, you're going to see a lot of dieback happening now. So the first cause would be from the powdery mildew. That will be the primary suspect. Now, this is where things get complicated. We usually plant nine bark for more for hedging purpose in a mass grouping. But when you do plant them in a mass grouping, it provides an ideal habitat for this fungal disease because they love the high humidity condition, which has been provided by the mass planting, and they will tend to spread out. So one thing you can do actually is that if you do have a bad branches or dead branches, okay, you can prune them anytime during the growing season. Most of the bad branches right now are almost dead. So you can prune them anytime. So in the springtime, you know, thin out some of the excess cane. Okay, you don't want to have a dense vegetation or thickets of those things. So if you do have some too much of those shoots going by, you can thin some of those things. And then, you know, and probably beginning in like in a late spring, early summer, that's where the infection starts to take place. You can actually apply some preventive fungicide to control this powdery mildew. Now, we do have an extension fact sheet that talks about powdery mildew control in woody ornamentals. Just Google up powdery mildew, UW extension, you will find this fact sheet. And we have listed, a plant pathologist, Dr. Brian Huddleston, has listed one of the homemade type of fungicide. On a very rare occasion, he lists some of this homemade type of fungicide. So this is one of the occasions he has listed it using some baking soda as well as some, you know, mixed with some oil. So check the fact sheet, And timing is very crucial in terms of applying this preventive fungicide. One more thing, when you're going to water any type of shrubs or any annual, including your nine bulb, water it just to the base of the plant. Don't do any overhead irrigation. Overhead irrigation spreads actually this fungal disease. So these are some of the few tips I would suggest to minimize, you know, your infections happening up in nine bulb. Perhaps, you know, this might be more helpful to you.
Great. Thank you, Catherine. Good luck with that nine bark. And such, they are very, very pretty shrubs. So our guest on Garden Talk today is Vijay Pandian. He is horticulture agent and educator for the UW Extension in Kenosha, Milwaukee, and Racine Counties. Join in with your questions, 800-642-1234, or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. You're listening to Garden Talk on The Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau. Join us on Monday at 11. Tech expert Beth D'Angelo will be back to talk with us about battery health, preventing lithium-ion battery fires, and making strong passwords. That's Monday on the Ideas Network. But right now, we're talking about gardening with Vijay Pandian. If you've got a question, we still have a line open, 800-642-1234, or you can send an email, ideas@wpr.org. And we'll take an email. This is from Evan in Athelstan. I'm sorry if I did not say that right. The Wisconsin DNR, he says that the Wisconsin DNR has private contracts and puts efforts into containing the spread of Japanese barberry bushes throughout Wisconsin woodlands. And he's seen that they're still being sold in nurseries as ornamental bushes. Do you feel that the DNR has adopted the most effective methods to control invasive, and what should they be doing better?
So, you know, many of the barberry plants, the species are invasive. But there are some cultivars, okay, that doesn't produce that much of seed, and they are not considered invasive species. So that's something, you know, the DNR, you know, traditionally has some regulations, you know, and they have listed what are the species, what are the cultivars that are, you know, exceptional. So, for example, the Japanese barberry one, which is Berberis thunbergii, and which is a scientific name, and the traditional species is actually restricted, but there are certain cultivars, you know, which are actually okay to use. So that's something that DNR has put forward, actually, in their website on the list of cultivars that you need to avoid because of it produces a lot of, you know, seed pods, and it can help in spreading. So so check into the Wisconsin DNR website to confirm, I know, what specific type of cultivars, you know, which is allowed, which is not allowed. So their website has a pretty good, you know, info on it.
Great. Yeah, do some research before you buy. It's always a good idea. Mm-hmm. Let's go to Linda in Wausau. Hi, Linda.
Hi. A couple of weeks ago on the show, I heard a comment, and I didn't get the full presentation about heritage trees. I have a shaky bark soft maple tree in our yard, and we went online and tried to figure out how old it was a while back, and we calculated that it's about 240 years old, and it's a magnificent tree. And it sounded like what I heard at the tail end of the presentation was that there's some sort of group in the state collecting seed pods and trying to cultivate these trees that have been, you know, very hardy over a long period of time in the state of Wisconsin. Is that true, and how would I follow up on that?
So that's a good question. I think probably, you know, the Wisconsin DNR may have some more info on it. So I know in the past, Wisconsin DNR has released some Wisconsin champion trees, and maybe you can touch base with that. The other thing is that, you know, check with the Madison City Foresters. So I know there is a program going in Madison about some heritage tree program. My colleague, my counterpartner, Lisa Johnson, is also involved in the heritage tree programs as well. So give a call to Madison, Dane County Extension Office, and talk to my counterpartner, Lisa Johnson, about their project on heritage trees, and she may be able to guide you in the right direction, or talk to the Wisconsin DNR about it.
Yeah, great advice. Linda, I know Lisa was on with us a couple of weeks back, so that could very well be who was talking about that. So give it a try and see what happens. So thanks for calling. Ed in Kenosha County, you are next.
Hello. About 15 years ago, I planted a quaking aspen, and it's doing beautifully. And it set up clones around it. This is in just kind of a deciduous area I was trying to establish. So it sets up clones and it's creating a little thicket. I'm okay with 15 of these little guys around it. But it's now sending shoots probably 30 feet away into areas where I don't want it. And certainly I don't want this whole thing to be taken over. Is it possible to, do I have to dig out all of these lateral roots or rhizomes or whatever they are? Or can I just cut them? I've heard some people say cut them and put some glyphosate. Even though it's part of a larger system, it won't affect the main mother tree. So how can I keep this thing from taking over?
Well, that's a very good question. And, you know, aspens, just like Tree of Heaven, you know, just tend to sprout out, but not as bad as Tree of Heaven. But the thing about, you know, in quaking aspen is that, you know, these sprouts, okay, you need to keep them down, keep constantly mowing or cutting them down. Now, there is a bit of a caution you need to do take into consideration. If you do start thinking about applying herbicide in the fall time, the herbicides can get translocated, you know, to the root system and to even to the mother plant. And depending upon the concentration and all those things, sometimes it could impact your mother plant as well. So if you still want to have the mother plant but want to control some of those, you know, root suckers, the best option is to constantly mow it down or cut it down. That'll be the way to go.
Okay. Yes, Ed, that works. I have not a problem, but a very aggressive shaking aspen too, and that seems to work. So try it. Next up, we've got Jill and Casco. Hi, Jill.
Good morning, Larry and VJ. Thanks for the great program this morning. My question is around fig trees and peach trees. Wondering where do you get fig trees for zone 5, and maybe any special care around them, as well as peach trees. And I'm looking for more of a smaller version tree, just so that we can harvest the fruit a little bit easier. So any help there would be wonderful. Thank you.
Well, that's a very good question. So I've been actually trialing a lot of different types of figs, actually, you know, trying to have a better understanding, you know, because when you look into the catalogs, they announce all the different types of fig trees labeled for zone 5A, 4B, 6. And it's all really cute and beautiful, you know, to see those figs because they're rich in antioxidants, good fibers and stuff. So, in fact, one of the most promising one that has been advertised in many catalogs is the Chicago Hardy Fig. So, this is from my personal trial program at Kenosha County Center that I tried it 3 years ago, and I planted it, and it grew really well. You know, I was surprised even the first year it grew about, like, you know, 3-4 feet tall. It started producing the fruit, but to my disappointment, it did not survive the winter. The winter was a mild winter. It was not a one, but it did not. So, and I had the same kind of result coming from other gardeners as well. So, you know, we are in zone 5A down there. And so I would say, you know, Chicago hardy fig may not be really, really hardy fig at all, but that led to me, because I also had another cultivar, Negroni cultivar. Negroni, And this is actually out of like, you know, experiment. I came to know that, you know, you stored it actually inside my office space, which has a large window, and it gets actually, you know, south-facing light. Believe me or not, it grew really very well. And the temperature inside was like 65 degrees, you know, most of the daytime. And even in the nighttime, it gets 20 to 60, 65. And it was like a beautiful house plant, which has giant leaves, like a gigantic leaf. And it started producing fruits like probably around like mid-March. And so, but the fruit was not ripened because it does need a little bit of a warm spell for the fruit to ripen. But one thing I learned about from the Negroni is that we talk about the chilling period for many of the fruit trees, but based on Negroni one, I didn't have any chilling period. Inside my office space, the temperature was 65 to 70 degrees, you know, most of the day and night time. And it grew really well, produced the flower fruits. And then in May, I dragged it back outside when we had a 1 week of warm weather. That warm weather, you know, ripened these fruits. So, I mean, this is an early stage of my experiment. So I'm kind of suspecting that you can able to overwinter these figs inside your house, you know, as a house plant. But I'm doing more study about it. I'll keep you posted later on that.
Oh, that's wonderful, Vijay, because I would love to grow a fig also. And when we come back after the news, maybe we can talk about peaches. So, Jill, stick around. We've been talking with Vijay Pandian. He is a horticulture agent and educator for the UW Extension in Kenosha, Milwaukee, and Racine counties. Stay with us. There's always more to come on the Ideas Network. For joining us today on Garden Talk. I'm Jill Nadeau. Glad to have you with us on the Ideas Network. We're talking with Vijay Pandian, horticulture educator for the UW Extension in Kenosha, Milwaukee, and Racine counties. What gardening questions do you have? Give us a call, 800-642-1234, or you can send an email to ideas@wpr.org. And Vijay, right before we went to the break, Jill in Casco, which is in the middle of Door County, by the way, in case anybody's wondering, had questions about fruit trees, fig, and also peach. Do you have any recommendations for peach trees for her?
Yes, in particular, you know, Jill was asking about dwarf peaches. I mean, you know, many gardeners love dwarf cultivars because it's easy to maintain and, you know, easy to, you know, harvest those fruits, you know. The peaches, and in particular, you know, in many other places in Wisconsin, they're not really hardy. I mean, in the last few years, you know, with the mild temperatures, people start to see some, these peaches can be grown easily in their backyard. But that being said, it takes only one polar vortex to knock it out.
Right.
So just be aware about this. Some of the traditional peach varieties, okay, that's something you can grow successfully is one is the Reliance. Reliance has been one of the most cold hardy type of peach varieties that has been recommended in Wisconsin. And it's a very nice peach. You know, it's very sweet, ripens in August. The other one I would say is that, you know, Contender. I mean, it's one of my master gardener in Kenosha County. She had success with Contender variety as well. And we also have a few other varieties listed in our extension publication. One is called McKay Interpret. And so these varieties, you know, you can grow them in your backyard, especially if you're living in Door County nearby the lake area. The lake provides a warming effect in the winter and, you know, microclimate effect in the winter time. So you can be able to grow them.
Mm-hmm.
But when it comes to the dwarf cultivar, that's where the tricky comes. The tricky is that many of the rootstock, the dwarf type of rootstock, they're not really hardy for Wisconsin. So, so we don't have a pretty good information, research-based information, on what type of dwarf cultivars or the rootstocks can able to support these peaches. So we don't have, for Wisconsin, a solid research base that tells these are some potential dwarf type of ones. Now, there are many commercial nurseries that you can get from, like, Stock Bros, Rain Tree Nurseries, online, you know. They advertise all this type of dwarf cultivar peaches, you know, and then list the hardiness, including Wisconsin. So you have to be very careful about it. If you do want it, try one variety and see how it goes. Mm-hmm. One thing about peaches is that it is not like apples. You need to get two different varieties for pollination purpose. Peaches are self-pollinated one. So get one variety, plant them in a little bit protected spot. At the same time, it doesn't need to be, you know, in a full sunny area, and see how it performs and grows.
Okay, thank you, Jill, for that question and for the info, Vijay. We did get an email from Rita. She said that her blueberry bushes have developed broom-type branches, which produce no berries. She's wondering if this is a fungus. Should she just prune it out, or what should she be doing?
So if you do have that kind of vicious broom type of symptom, so what it means is that, so from one of the, branch ends, you see multiple branches comes out like a broom. And so these type of vicious broom symptoms, it may not be a fungal. It could be a phytoplasma or a viral type of thing. I would immediately, send a sample to our plant pathologist, Dr. Brian Huddleston. So, you can go to the Plant Disease Diagnostic Center, pddc.wis.edu, or just Google up Plant Disease Diagnostic Center, Wisconsin, UW-Madison. You can send a sample, get it tested. That is very important, because if you don't know what you're dealing with, let's say if it's a disease issue, you don't want to spread this disease to other healthy blueberry plants. At the same time, make sure to disinfect your pruning tool if you're going to prune it, just to minimize the spread. In case if it's an infection, you can minimize it. So I would take that as a first step, send a sample, get it tested. And maybe, that would be a cause of it, causing, no fruits or no flower production,
Okay. We've got Sandy in La Crosse with a question. Go ahead, Sandy.
Thank you. I have a question about the lilacs. We have an older stand, has not done well the last 2 years, and it has patches of white on the bark, and they just don't look healthy. I'm trying to find if it's a fungus, or if it is, do I have to destroy the whole patch? Do I cut them down to the ground now and hope it doesn't spread to the new sprouts?
Say. If you're dealing with like an old Chinese lilac varieties, okay, and we typically use those type of, older varieties for screening purpose, hedging purpose, okay. So what I see is that, okay, there is a good possibility that some of the older branches or the older stems, they might have dead over the winter time. So what you're seeing right now, those white patches could be a tiny, tiny mushrooms, polypus mushrooms that actually, thriving on those dead or decaying branches. And that's what you might be seeing. So it's a good indicator that, okay, that section of the bark or that section of the stem seems to be collapsed down. And that may be the reason for it. So the cause for it, why it collapsed down, if you go back to it, that could be multiple things. One, it could be more of a stress-related issue, or it could be some sort of like another type of, the branches doesn't get enough light or enough moisture. So all these things could actually impact to it. So when you have a lilac patches, the old Chinese lilac type patches growing as a hedge, make sure to prune those things, you know, prune some of the older canes so that you, you revitalize those plants by producing, causing the plant to produce some new young shoots. So remove some of the older ones. So that is called one-third principle. What it means is that if you have six older canes, okay, and start from the middle in the innermost one and take two of it completely down to the ground in 1 year. And then in the next following year, take the remaining two. So in that way, you strategize it, you know, in removing some of the older canes. By removing the older canes, you let a lot of light, air penetration in it. You let some of the younger new canes come to, you know, fruition and start producing more flowers to it. In that way, you can keep your lilac patches, the Chinese lilac patches, more healthy. So in your case, I'm suspecting that you may have older patches, may not have been pruned, you may not prune some of the older canes, and they might have died, you know, over the winter, and you're seeing all these mushrooms, which are whitish in color, that's popping out of it.
Thank you for the question, Sandy. Kellen Sugarcamp, you're up next.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. It was very interesting listening about the peach trees. I was wondering if you have any recommendations for apricot trees or Bartlett pear trees that might make it through the winter here.
So where exactly do you live, ma'am? In which part of the state?
North. I'm just north of Rhinelander.
Oh, okay. So apricots, it is toddy for Wisconsin, okay? But the problem is, the time it blooms, it always coincides with the spring frost. I used to live in Bayfield and for about a year, and back in that time, 2005, 2006, it has a beautiful array of flowers, but it coincides exactly at the time with the spring frost. So that is a tricky thing about apricots. But some of the apricot varieties you can try, actually, that has been listed in our publication. So you just Google up fruit cultivars for Wisconsin and type in UWEX, and you will find this publication. And some of the varieties that is really hardy for Wisconsin and you can go is called, one is called Hardcott, Moon Gold, Sun Gold. So these are some very good varieties. You can plant it. And there is one variety from Canada, from Manitoba, it's called Westcott. And so some of these very hardy ones, you can plant them in Wisconsin. So again, the problem, the trick comes is that the timing it blooms and how it's going to coincide with the spring frost. You know, in some years we are lucky, it'll be good. Some years if not, then probably, we're going to lose it. Sometimes you can use some sort of like a floating row cover. If the tree is like a small size, you can use a floating row cover just for some few nights to prevent some of those spring frost injury on the flowers.
Okay, good luck, Kel. If you find something that works, share it with us. I'd love to hear that. Amy in Iola, you are up next.
Hello. I have an apple tree that is towering over my roof, and I'm considering cutting it down. It has tiny yellow apples. It smells beautiful in the spring in the second-story room. But I wonder if there's a way to prune it, or if it's something heirloom I should keep, or if I could prune it, basically. Can I prune a 26-foot-tall tree?
So pruning a mature apple tree, which you haven't actually ever done in training and pruning, and now it's outgrown itself and trying to prune it, that's going to be very tough, trying to contain some of those overgrown apple trees. It is not easy. So my suggestion would be is to find actually a local apple grower. So, you can go to the Wisconsin Apple Grower Association website. See if there are any local apple growers in your area. See if you can able to hire them to prune your overgrown apple trees. You cannot prune actually and contain its growth all in a single year. It needs to be strategized and pruned properly. If you want to save it, you need to do that for probably 3 to 5 years. So that would be my first step, to find any local apple growers, hire them, see if they can able to help you out. Homeowners, sometimes they may tend to do, but when you have about 20 feet, 25 feet tall apple trees, it is quite risky.
Okay. Thank you, Amy. Let's go to an email. We had, let me get here real quick, Annette. Annette emailed us, and apparently she has a raised bed and has four cucumber plants. The leaves closest to the roots are getting light brown spots and then drying up. The leaves are at the distal end are green, and there are many blossoms but few fruit. What can be causing this? And just to note, the local deer have nipped at the plants, and could this be a cause?
So cucumbers, they are susceptible to various leaf spot diseases. One of the common ones is called the angular leaf spot diseases, okay? And all these leaf spot diseases are associated with high humidity. So if you're growing a cucumber in a raised bed, make sure you have a trellis. So at the back of the bed, you know, either you use a cattle fence, you know, hog pen fence, or some sort of like a netting type of materials, and try to train your cucumbers to grow vertically up. So that promotes a lot of aeration. And that will help in minimizing some of these leaf spot diseases, which is associated with high humidity. And also make sure that when you're watering your cucumber, water just to the base of it, not to the foliage. So I'm suspecting that, you know, you may have some sort of like a leaf spot disease. To confirm it, take a photograph and send it to our plant pathologist, Dr. Brian Huddleston, you know, our plant disease diagnostic clinic, to confirm it. So I think that'll be the one of the first and critical steps you need to do. You know, you need to know what you're dealing with at first, okay? So I think that might be the most common question that I do see in the field, even in my flower garden, to see all these leaf spot diseases in cucumbers.
Mm-hmm. If you've got a call, give us a, excuse me, if you've got a question, give us a call, 800-642-1234. And we've got Kevin in Minocqua who has something for you. Go ahead, Kevin.
Hi. I have three orchards. One is a hickory orchard, another is an apple orchard, and the other is a plum orchard. They all have different concerns. The plum orchard, I'd like to maximize the fruit quality. And I have a soil sample here, but I'm wondering if I should send in a foliage sample instead. The hickory orchard, I just want to make sure to maximize the possibility that it would bear fruit in my lifetime, so maximum growth. And then the apple orchard, I had put rotted logs underneath the soil around the trees, and I'm concerned some of them are getting yellow, maybe a lack of nitrogen. So I'm not sure how to take a soil sample for that. But I guess the main question is, should I use a foliage sample or a soil sample for these tubs?
Okay. So here's what I would suggest you, sir. Reach out to Dr. Amaya Atucha. Dr. Amaya, is our fruit specialist. So she's based out of UW Madison, and so you can get her contact information from UW Madison. Just Google up UW Madison, Dr. Amaya Atucha, and she's our fruit crop extension specialist. And since you have a decent size, you know, orchard, you know, she can able to give you and provide you a better information. Is it related to a nutrient issue that you need a foliar testing rather than a soil testing in your plum, or is something else going on in your plum orchard? Same thing with the apples and hickories. So she is the right person that you need to consult about it. Again, her name is Dr. Amaya Atucha, and she's with the UW Madison Department of Horticulture and serving as a fruit crop extension specialist.
Good advice. Amaya's been with us a few times. Pretty easy if you just Google Amaya Atucha, I believe is how she spells that.
Yep.
So, okay. So you'll get contact information for her, and she knows tons. So good luck, Kevin. I'm on this group in Facebook for Wisconsin Gardening, and there's been a number of people questioning the pictures of tomatoes with a big black dot on the bottom of them. Why don't you talk a little bit about that, VJ, and what that could be and how to maybe stop that from happening?
Well, you're not the only one, or your friends from your face groups, you're not the only one. It is a common thing, actually.
Yes.
I mean, it's a physiological disorder called blossom end rot. So what it means is that it is not a disease or anything. You don't have to get panicked about it. So usually the first set of fruits at the tail end of the fruit, you'll see more brownish, blackish in color. And that's because actually one of the secondary nutrients called calcium, if it doesn't get properly circulated into the fruit system, it produces a very thin wall, you know, thin cell wall on the fruit skin and makes it more vulnerable to root rot, you know, like a fruit rots and stuff like that. And that attacks it on that end, causing it to turn more blackish and brownish in color. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the many gardeners think that, oh, it is actually due to calcium, so maybe I need to add more calcium, you know, to it. Logically, if you think like, yeah, it is maybe, but the reality is that the calcium, we do have a lot of calcium in the soil. The calcium is not properly circulated because we don't water it, you know, on a regular basis on our tomato plant. So many people, many gardeners, you know, including myself, I have to tell.
And me.
Oh, when the, yeah. I'm a lazy gardener sometimes. I have to admit that. So when the plant shows a sign of temporary wilting, we go and, you know, water the plant, you know. So what happens is that the calcium gets stuck in the leaves, and it doesn't get flown properly to the fruit. So if you do a good job in regularly watering it, the calcium gets properly circulated into the fruit system.
Mm-hmm.
So good watering is very essential. Second thing, you know, if a tomato has too much foliage, all this foliage competes for calcium to leaving a little bit of calcium to the fruit. So don't trigger too much growth on your tomato plant. Like, for example, sometimes gardeners tend to fertilize very frequently to get a very bushy tomato plant. Like every other week, they tend to add some Miracle-Gro or apply some nitrogen fertilizer. Don't do those things, okay? So, you know, about like a 3 times in a season is good enough in applying some nutrients for your tomatoes. So that would be another thing to think about it to minimize the blossom end rot. If you're actually thinking about growing your tomatoes in containers, they are more vulnerable to blossom end rot because in container system, it's a different story. When you water your container, most of the water leaches out, you know, the nutrients, including the calcium, you know. So, and container one, you need to water it more frequently to make sure the plants are healthy and, you know, doesn't wilt. So more frequent watering drains out. So in those cases, sometimes you may want to think about, you know, adding a little bit of, you know, calcium beginning in the growing season, okay? Not right now, it's too late, okay? So these are some few things you need to consider to minimize, you know, the blossom end rot, you know, happening again in your tomatoes. But many tomato plants, when they start producing the second set of fruit, they will tend to show perfectly fine. You won't find this kind of blossom end rot, you know, these symptoms.
Yeah, I've noticed that myself. What is it? It's okay to eat the fruit, though, isn't it? Can you just kind of?
It is perfectly fine. Just slice off the damaged piece, and then you can use it for, you know, direct consumption or for processing purpose. You can use it. Yes.
Okay. And last minute here before we have to go, Vijay, why don't you tell us a little bit more about the Learning Store and all of those publications for the extension?
Absolutely. So, you know, UW-Madison Division of Extension Horticulture Program has produced actually a lot of wonderful publication, which has been hosted in our extension website. So just Google up Wisconsin Horticulture Extension, and you will find tons of, you know, resources, including fact sheets, publications, and YouTube videos, upcoming webinars in related to gardening. Or if you have any questions related to your gardening, you know, you can find, you know, the information in that website.
Okay. Great. Thanks, Vijay. Sorry to cut you off. We got to go. Vijay, of course, is with the Yuck Extension. I'm Jill Nadeau. I'm in for Larry. Stay well.